I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. The Florida House and Senate have each passed a budget, but there's a big gap between the two budgets, a $4 billion gap, in fact. The reason why lawmakers in the House and Senate are so far apart, a disagreement over health care, and specifically whether or not to expand Medicaid now that a $1 billion fund for indigent care is going away. To talk more about the budget and the prospects of Medicaid expansion in Florida, I'll speak with 90.7's health reporter Abe Abariah and University of Central Florida political science professor Aubrey Jewett. Later in the program, a new Quinnipiac poll shows strong support for medical marijuana in Florida, but will it be enough to get a revised constitutional amendment passed? I'll talk to Orlando attorney and outspoken advocate for medical marijuana, John Morgan. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined on the phone now by Professor Aubrey Jewett from the University of Central Florida. Professor Jewett, welcome back to Intersection.
Ah, thanks. Nice to be on again.
Well, two competing budgets, the House and the Senate, both voting to approve their budgets last week. So let's just remind our listeners what the difference is. We're talking billions of dollars here between the House and the Senate versions of their budgets.
Yes, indeed, we are. The Florida House has approved a budget of about $76 billion, and the Florida Senate has approved one of about $80 billion. And the difference is really about how are we going to pay for health care for low-income Floridians.
Mm-hmm.
It basically is about whether or not Florida is going to expand Medicaid under Obamacare, or at least under a Florida plan that's not exactly Obamacare, but that gets us sort of a waiver from the traditional rules and allows us to expand. And then also because the federal government has said that they are not going to be providing money, most likely under a traditional program called the low-income pool that reimburses hospitals for their expenses. Now, the Senate has included that money in it, and the House has not, at least currently. So between those two things, that's about a $4 billion difference.
Mm-hmm. So that low-income pool funding you're talking about, you know, what happens to Florida when that low-income pool funding runs out, and when does it run out? When does the federal government say, that's it, the tap's being shut off?
Well, from what I've read, basically about the end of June, so we only really have a few months, either to determine that the federal government indeed is telling the truth and that they are not going to spend it, or to have Florida convince them that they should continue that program. And in fact, the governor supposedly has already been contacting federal officials about continuing that. Although I did read another story where basically, you know, Florida says there is no negotiations, and so does the House, and so that Florida says there is no negotiations, and so does the federal government, so there might not even be discussions about it right now.
Mm-hmm.
And if I might revisit that briefly also, you said when would it end and discussions and things, but we'd probably see something, you know, this summer at the end of June. And basically what it means is that many Florida hospitals who are, you know, currently participating in that program would see a huge hit to their budget, because they're taking all these indigent patients who show up in emergency rooms, sometimes for real emergencies, but other times for things maybe that are not emergencies, but the people don't have health care, and so this is the only way they can get treatment. And the hospitals do, of course, under law, have to see people who show up at the emergency room. And, currently at least they get some money for that through this federal program, but starting at the end of June, if things don't change, they won't be getting money.
Mm-hmm.
And so you really see a lot of pressure on the legislature, and really on the federal government as well, from the hospitals to say, hey, we don't want to get caught in the middle here. We're not sure how you guys are going to work this out, but if you expect us to do a good job and treat people who show up at the emergency room and don't have insurance and don't have money, you know, we have to be paid and reimbursed because we have hospital expenses, we have to pay the doctors, et cetera.
So the Senate's plan, spearheaded by Andy Gardner, does that fix the problem? And does that allow Florida to keep collecting that federal money?
Well, yes, that's what the Senate says. You know, but again, part of the difference is because of basically accepting a different pool of Medicaid funds to expand Medicaid. Basically, under the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as it's commonly called, the state, many other states have already done this, could expand Medicaid to people who are above the poverty line but don't make enough money to buy insurance on the health exchanges that have been set up online. Basically, if you're the working poor, to at least make a decent amount of money, then the expectation is you go buy your own health insurance and you get a big subsidy on the website. Mm-hmm. But if you're the working poor and you're really, let's say, making minimum wage and you got a family of three or four, and you know that's just not making enough money, even with the subsidy that might be available to purchase, then this expansion of Medicaid would basically allow those people, or cover those people through Medicaid, or in Florida's version, basically Florida's trying to set up sort of an HMO kind of a thing for these folks, and would presumably get federal approval to do so, rather than putting them in traditional Medicaid.
Mm-hmm. So what about the governor? I mean, how much pressure can he bring to bear on, say, the Florida House if they say, no, they're just not going to negotiate, they're not going to buy this plan from the Florida Senate?
Well, you know, historically, the governor is the lobbyist in chief, you know, chief legislator, as we like to call him sometimes in my political science classes. He does certainly have a role in shaping legislation, but you know, mostly all he can do is cajole and ask people. He did say about a couple, I guess it's been at least a couple years ago, maybe three, that he would support the expansion of Medicaid in Florida as long as the federal government was paying all costs. And under the Affordable Care Act, what the federal government did was say, hey, we will, for the first 3 years, pay 100% of the cost of expanding this program. And Governor Scott had traditionally, like most Republicans, when the Affordable Care Act passed, when Obamacare passed, had said he was against it, they wouldn't participate in it. But he did, at least publicly, you know, say he had a change of heart about a year or two after. But unfortunately, he's never really done anything about it other than just announce he would sign it if the legislature ever did it, and he's never really lobbied aggressively to get them to pass it. So I don't know. I mean, theoretically, he could, you know, contact legislative leaders, and particularly the budget chair and the House Speaker, and really try to push him to do this, and really in the past not only push him to do it, but governors also might threaten other programs, basically saying, you know, if you want other things to pass that you want, you know, you need to do this. You've got to do this, and try to really push him. But he's shown no sign of doing that so far. Mm-hmm. Other than just the broad statement that he would support it. He hasn't really pushed for it.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm speaking with UCF political science professor Aubrey Jewett about the Florida budget. The conversation continues after this break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking about the Florida budget with University of Central Florida political science professor Aubrey Jewett. Well, the legislative session is halfway done, a little more than halfway done. Do lawmakers have enough time to come to some kind of consensus over the budget?
Well, they definitely have the time to do it. And as I said, it's not uncommon. In fact, it's a regular occurrence that the House and the Senate would have different spending priorities, that their initial budgets would be different. But this is, in my recollection, you know, one of the certainly the largest dollar amount difference that I've seen between an initial House and Senate budget, and probably even as a percent, you know, because the budget, except when we were in the Great Recession, the budget usually goes up every year because the economy grows and tax collection goes up. So, you know, just saying it's the biggest dollar amount might not be as impressive as saying I do think it's also, you know, the biggest, you know, percentage difference, you know, $4 billion out of potentially $80 billion or $76 billion, you're talking like at least 5% of the budget there. That's a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. And because it deals with Obamacare, that's been such a contentious issue in the last few years, does that make it more or less likely that they can come to some agreement and reconcile those two figures?
Well, yeah, and I think that's an excellent point. Because at heart, this is about whether or not Florida participates in some variation, in some way, shape, or form of Obamacare, it makes it much less likely to get an agreement. Because basically, you know, many Republicans in the Senate are, you know, theoretically opposed to Obamacare or ideologically opposed, however you want to put it. But in the Senate, they also have they just tend to be more moderate a little bit, and they look at the bigger picture, and they basically say, look, you know, we've got all these Floridians who don't have health coverage. There's this huge pot of money, and the federal government has, you know, promised to pay Florida billions of dollars over the next several years, billions with a B, if we just participate in this program. And thus, even though ideologically we don't like it, even though the U.S. Congress may at some point, you know, change this program, and we'd even support it as good Republicans, you know, we really should just take this money.
Mm-hmm.
And big business in Florida, the Florida Chamber and the Associated Industries of Florida, you know, to name two of the largest, you know, business associations in the state, they're fighting for this hard. They want Florida to take the money. You know, they think, you know, from an economic, you know, business perspective, it's what they should do. And, of course, as I already mentioned, you know, all the hospitals in Florida, or at least most of the hospitals that I'm aware of, want Florida to take the money as well.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you've got the House, and the Republican leadership in the House, and really most rank-and-file Republicans in the House, they tend to be very conservative, and they are not in the mood to compromise. They just think Obamacare is just a horrible idea generally, and they don't like it because President Obama is the one that pushed it through. They don't like it for philosophical reasons because of the individual mandate, and they think it's a federal intrusion. Some have even said, you know, we don't like it because it expands Medicaid, and actually some studies have shown Medicaid's even worse than not having insurance. It's better for people not to have insurance and just show up than it is to be covered under Medicaid. You have worse health outcomes. So some have said that. But bottom line is, yeah, the House and the Senate just are taking a totally different view, and because it's Obamacare and Obama's so controversial and the program's so controversial among Republicans, it makes it very difficult to reach an agreement between the two sides, which eventually they have to reach one constitutionally. It's the one thing that the legislature has to accomplish, which is pass a budget. That's the only thing specifically written in the Florida Constitution mm-hmm. for the legislature to accomplish. If they didn't do anything else and pass one other bill, that would be fine constitutionally. But so far, they haven't done the one thing yet.
Aubrey Jewett, is this the biggest challenge that Governor Scott has faced yet?
I would think yes. You know, some might argue that the first year or two that he was in office, when we were still in the Great Recession and we had such a big budget deficit, quite frankly, you know, and that certainly was a big challenge. But I think the difference there was basically, you know, with some differences, the House and the Senate and the governor were more or less on the same page, meaning that pretty much they all agreed, hey, we're all Republicans, and we don't agree with tax increases, and we agree with living within our means. So other than a few fees and things like that, which we might agree to raise, you know, we're not going to raise taxes, which means we're just going to bite the bullet and cut back on spending. And so that first year he had to cut back on education spending, which he had promised he wouldn't do. So that was a pretty big challenge, too. But I would say this is probably a bigger challenge, because the House and Senate, although still both controlled by Republicans, are just at odds about what to do. And quite frankly, the Governor Scott does not have a lot of influence with either side. Ideologically, he's more in tune with the House, quite frankly, probably his own personal ideology, even though he has said he was willing to sign off on an expansion. But he really just has very little influence. I mean, he barely won re-election himself. You know, by about a percentage point. Almost every member of the House and Senate won by a wider margin. And plus they know he's a lame duck governor as well. He can't run again. He's term limited out. So mm-hmm. between winning by a very little amount, not having great public approval ratings, and not being able to run again, he just doesn't have much influence. So mm-hmm. that adds to the challenge as well.
It's interesting you make that point about ideology versus practicality, because, you know, when you look at Governor Scott's history, he comes from a health administration background. So you could imagine some of those people who are in the health care industry getting his ear and saying, look, this is you know how these things work. Let's kind of cut a deal here.
Absolutely. I suspect that if he was still the head of HCA or some variation, you know, basically if he was in charge of hospitals, he'd be advocating to take the federal money because, you know, hey, if you're running a hospital and you're responsible, you know, for the profit and loss of a hospital and for making sure that you have the funds to adequately cover emergency room care, basically this is money that has been approved at the federal level. Floridians pay taxes, and, you know, they're not getting this federal money back right now into the state, which many other states are currently.
Been speaking to UCF political science professor Aubrey Jewett. Aubrey, thank you very much for joining me.
Absolutely, Matthew. Thanks.
Joining me now to talk more about the rift over Medicaid expansion is 90.7 health reporter Abe Abaraya. Abe, welcome back to Intersection.
Thrilled to be here.
Okay, so what happens next with the state's budget?
Well, as you pointed out, there's a $4 billion difference between those two budgets, so they have to negotiate a compromise between the two chambers. So basically what happens is the head of each committee on each side will negotiate a common deal, but if they can't come to terms, it actually goes up the leadership chain.
Okay, so that means it could come down to Senate President Andy Gardner negotiating directly with House Speaker Steve Crisafulli.
Absolutely, and both of them are from Central Florida.
All right, so there's something in common there, but there is a pretty big gap between the two budgets. $4 billion, that's a lot of money. Why is that?
Well, two big reasons. One, the Senate budget is expecting the end of a $2.2 billion fund called the Low Income Pool, and that helps to pay for the healthcare costs of people who don't have insurance in Florida. And this is a joint program with the state and the federal government, and it was set to expire last year, but it was given a one-year extension. The program is set to expire again in June, and it's looking pretty unlikely that the federal government will extend it.
Okay, so where does that $2.2 billion go to?
Mostly to hospitals, although about a quarter of the fund goes to insurance companies who care for Medicaid patients. But hospitals in South Florida would take the biggest hit if the fund were to go away. Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami would lose $237 million every year. And here in Central Florida, it's not anything to sneeze at here either. Hospitals that are within broadcast range of WMFE could lose $146 million every year.
Okay, that's a lot of money. So those hospital companies must be sweating a bit. Some big dollar amounts at stake here. What about the other healthcare elephant in the room, though, Abe, the expansion of Medicaid?
Well, that's how the Senate budget tackles the loss of that low-income pool by expanding Medicaid, and that would potentially bring in $51 billion over the next decade to Florida.
Okay, but isn't that the point? I mean, from the federal government's perspective, they already have a way to pay for uncompensated care in Florida, and that's by expanding Medicaid.
Exactly. And as Senator Bill Nelson pointed out when he was in Tallahassee lobbying for this, the federal government doesn't want to pay for that health care twice, so now it's reckoning time. Now, keep in mind the Senate's Medicaid plan isn't strictly an expansion per se. It would draw down that money and use it to buy private insurance, and the recipients would have, they'd have to have a job, they'd have monthly premiums, they'd have co-pays, so it's a little bit different than traditional Medicaid.
So why are Republicans in the Florida House opposed to the expansion of Medicaid?
Well, after watching the debate on this, there is definitely an us-versus-them feeling from the Florida House. Governor Rick Scott has said in the past that the state should take the money, although his position on that may be changing. Florida Senate's budget anticipates the loss of that low-income pool and expands Medicaid. So the Florida House is kind of the outlier on this. They're the one remaining holdout on taking these federal dollars. And many of those who spoke in favor of rejecting the Medicaid expansion say that Medicaid's a broken system, it's been resistant to change. And here's Pasco County Republican Richard Corcoran, who's chair of the very powerful Appropriations Committee.
I'll proudly declare war on all the special interests, every single one of which. All the Gucci loafing, shoe-wearing special interest powers that be that are sitting in that hallway, every single one of them wants Medicaid expansion. None of them want the other stuff. Come to war with us. I'll fight. And if it costs me my political career or yours, so be it.
All right. So the vote was 86 in the House for the budget, 29 against and 4 absent. And was that along party lines?
Yes and no. Every single no vote came from Democrats. But there were a handful of Democrats like Orlando's Bruce Antone who spoke in favor of the budget, or excuse me, who voted in favor of the budget. And many of the Democrats who spoke in opposition said denying the expansion of Medicaid is based kind of on partisan politics, and that's just because it's associated with President Obama's health care law. So expanding Medicaid would provide a boost to the economy and create jobs, they say, as well as save lives.
Okay, saving lives? That sounds pretty dramatic.
Researchers have studied states that didn't expand Medicaid and compared them to the states that did. And the estimate in Florida is that between 1,100 and 2,200 deaths would be prevented annually by expanding Medicaid. And here's an example of how that works. In 2011, a man from South Florida died while waiting for a liver transplant in Orlando. That man had a toothache and no insurance, and he treated the toothache with Tylenol and over-the-counter drugs, and those eventually destroyed his liver. So having insurance may have made a trip to the dentist more affordable, which could have saved his life.
Okay, but this isn't just about health insurance for the poor. I mean, you mentioned that $146 million, which hospitals here in Central Florida could lose. And, you know, this would affect businesses and health insurance rates across the board, right?
Absolutely. Government programs like Medicare and Medicaid reimburse hospitals less than the cost of care. So to stay afloat, they basically take those losses out from private health insurance rates. And so if you're losing $2.2 billion, that loss has to be absorbed somehow, that the patient care isn't going away. So that could mean higher health insurance rates for businesses and their employees.
So, Abe Abariah, the House's budget didn't ignore health care, though, did it?
Absolutely. They're tucked into that $76.2 billion, there are quite a few little health care nuggets. There's money to reduce wait times to get into long-term care for Medicaid. There's increased funding for children's medical services, pay increases for Medicaid doctors. There's more money for training new doctors. And there's even money to study digestive diseases at the University of Central Florida here locally.
Just not the expansion of Medicaid. Well, Abe Abariah, 90.7's health reporter, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be here.
Up next, Orlando attorney John Morgan talks about his new bid to get medical marijuana legalized in Florida. After a constitutional amendment to legalize medical marijuana just failed to get enough votes last November, advocates are trying to get it on the ballot again in 2016. A new Quinnipiac poll shows 84% of Floridians support medical marijuana, but attorney John Morgan, who's spearheading the bid to get medical marijuana legalized, says it's still a long way to go until the 2016 election.
Well, it was 80% before the onslaught last time, so I'm cautious. And, you know, this, getting 60% of a vote in any election is a landslide, so I don't take much solace in it.
When you think about the difference between 2014 and 2016, though, I mean, people always say that you get a better turnout in a presidential year, so do you draw some comfort from that?
100%. I mean, we had an election for governor where the question was not who do you want the most, but who do you want the least. And there was no turnout. Dade and Broward was empty.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, a presidential turnout year is always going to be better for an initiative like this.
What's the strategy going forward then if you had such good support 6 months out from the election last time around and that sort of melted away come voting day? What are you going to do differently this time?
Well, I learned a lot from last time. The thing I learned was, you know, turnout matters, so that'll take care of itself thanks to the presidential election. The second thing that I learned is that even with low turnout, we got almost 60% of the vote, which was more than any statewide candidate got. I learned that probably 80% of the people do want it, but many of them don't want it in the form of a constitutional amendment. I think one of the advantages we'll have this time is that the legislature will have had the opportunity to have fixed this, to have enacted this, but they didn't. I've had many conversations with the legislature this year. I've conceded on many big issues, but I don't think it's going to happen in Tallahassee. And I think the people of Florida will say, you know what, we gave Tallahassee the opportunity to fix it. Yeah, we don't think a constitutional amendment is the best way, but it may be the only way. And then finally, we've tweaked our amendment to get rid of some of the red herrings and falsehoods that were argued last time. And I think if we take that all, you know, cumulatively, then it has a good chance.
When you also think about why the amendment didn't pass in 2014, are you concerned that, you know, you've got good support now, but there's also quite a bit of time for opponents for medical marijuana reform to get their ducks in a row as well and get some kind of campaign off the ground?
Of course, and I saw that last time. You know, we had a rich guy from Las Vegas who pumped in all sorts of money spreading lies and distortions about what was going to happen. The drug dealers were going to be taking care of our loved ones and hospices. It was ridiculous, but you got the electorate out there. When you get everything, all the electric, and by the way, I'm almost part of it. Once you get to, 60 years and older, the votes against medical marijuana really start to pile up. And the folks between 60 and 85 years old don't really understand even what it is. If you ask them to tell you the difference between marijuana and heroin, they'd have a hard time. So they're the group that's most susceptible to believe in lies, but also, ironically, the group that's most likely to need medical marijuana in the future when they're laying in a hospice. So I think what I learned from the last time, that I will spend a lot more time educating people my age and older.
Mm-hmm. And finally, John Morgan, do you think having a presidential candidate from Florida could make any difference, either for or against this issue?
Here's the ironic thing. Many Republicans are in favor of this. All libertarians are, and most Democrats. And so I think if we have Jeb or Marco on the ballot, that the turnout will be gigantic. And I think turnout helps me. Look, there's a certain amount of people out there who I can never change their mind. And most of those people are the crowd that votes come hell or high water. They're bored out of their ever-loving gills. They've got nothing to do. They always vote. And they're the most uninformed. If they just do what they're told. And so I can never get to that crowd. But I can get to the enlightened and the open crowd. There's a certain voter that's hopeless. You've got the voter who's had their lives destroyed by some kind of hard drug and they blame marijuana. You've got a part of the electorate who doesn't really even understand what it is. So we've now been this one cycle. We've given Tallahassee the opportunity. They can't or won't. We now know that we want it, but if we got to get it, we're going to do it our own way. And I've taken away all the issues that they had by tweaking my language. So I'm hopeful that second time's a charm.
Been speaking to John Morgan, Orlando attorney and supporter of medical marijuana reform. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
The conversation continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.